Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author and columnist Naomi Klein, who discusses her view that the Bush administration's economic plan for Iraq is but one element of a broader strategy to expand the power and wealth of U.S.-based multinational corporations across the globe. Dr. Quentin Young, National Coordinator with Physicians for a National Health Program, who takes a critical look at recently approved congressional legislation authorizing a Medicare prescription drug plan. And Tyson Slocum, a Public Citizen's Critical Mass Energy Program, who examines the link between California's current economic crisis and earlier manipulation of the state's energy supply by companies such as Enron. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While the U.S.-backed roadmap for peace in the Middle East requires that Israel dismantle settlement outposts established since March 2001 and freeze all settlement activity in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, the actual cost of maintaining these settlements is falling under greater scrutiny. A recent article in Mother Jones magazine revealed that Israel has been slow to disclose the percentage of its budget used to protect its settlement outposts, but settlers are given preferential treatment to those living inside Israel's borders and have become a huge drain on the nation's failing economy. Interior Ministry audits show that settlements receive 50% more per resident than communities within Israel, in addition to hefty tax incentives and extensive army security. From the beginning, says Yeheskel Lean, a researcher for the B'Tselem Human Rights Group, the intent has been to break up the contiguity of Palestinian communities by building settlements and roads. Settlements known as outposts are little more than a group of mobile homes parked on strategic hilltops to establish some Israeli presence in key areas. Peace Now and other human rights groups have been trying to determine the cost of the settlements and found that Israel spent an extra $430 million on settlers, or $2,000 per person, in a country where the GDP per capita is only $17,000. Ariel Sharon is one of Israel's biggest supporters of settler outposts, but now says he is willing to dismantle some in the interest of peace. But it remains to be seen how far the Likud party leader will go in alienating right-wing settlers, his base of political support. The New Internationalist magazine reports that South Africa's move toward privatization is driving a wedge between the ruling African National Congress and two of its longtime allies, the Congress of South African Trade Unions and the South African Communist Party. The wedge was driven deeper when President Thabo Mbeki announced earlier this year the government's plan to sell Telkom, the state-run telephone company, in the name of black economic power. The people's opposition to privatization of basic water and electric power services prompted a two-day national strike last October that idled a quarter of South Africa's workforce. Across South African townships, over 10 million people have had power and water cut off, resulting in the spread of cholera and tuberculosis. Increasingly, municipal trade union workers are leaving the ANC and joining the anti-privatization forum in major cities and talking about creating an alternative political party to the ANC. In the fight to save Telkom, the Union Federation has blasted the company's policy changes, which cut off basic phone service in poor townships, while slashing rates for business customers and internet users. Meanwhile, in many areas, activists continue to take matters into their own hands by illegally reconnecting water and power service. Interest rates are at their lowest in 40 years. However, the American economy is limping along, with growing numbers of the unemployed and few prospects of new jobs anytime soon. In April, the Federal Reserve Board took a Japan-style deflation scenario seriously when monthly government reports showed falling wholesale and retail prices. According to The Nation magazine, the U.S. economy is still suffering from a massive overcapacity in technology built up in the late 1990s. Personal debt is now 130% of disposable income, a 30% increase over the last decade, and factories are only using 73% of their production capacity, its lowest level since the 1982 recession. The specter of deflation threatens most investments with a decline in value, including stocks and real estate. Still, few market fundamentalists in Washington are looking at dramatic action to fix the economy. All the Bush team can offer is more tax cuts for the wealthy. According to The Nation magazine's William Grider, the solution to pumping up the $11 trillion American economy is simple. The government needs to print more dollars and spend more money to create jobs. But most politicians, Democrat and Republican, are afraid to embrace a pro-inflation strategy. This week's news summary was compiled by Britta Brundage and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
The military occupation of Iraq has not gone according to plans made in Washington long before the war was launched against Saddam Hussein's government. Since President Bush declared major hostilities over in Iraq on May 1st, more than 30 U.S. and British troops have been killed in an intensifying series of guerrilla attacks. With an average of 13 engagements each day between U.S. soldiers and armed Iraqis hostile to the occupation, American military leaders are still reluctant to characterize the resistance as an organized effort. Instead, Pentagon and Bush administration officials maintain that groups attacking U.S. forces are remnants of Saddam's Ba'athist Party, or terrorists sympathetic to al-Qaeda. Fueling hostility toward the U.S. and Iraq are the increasing number of civilians being shot by jittery and exhausted American soldiers, the delay in establishing an Iraqi transition government, and the spotty restoration of electrical and water services. Recent statements made by L. Paul Bremer III, President Bush's administrator in Iraq, that the U.S. will work to privatize Baghdad's state-owned industries has further antagonized many Iraqis. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with author and columnist Naomi Klein, who discusses her view that the Bush administration's economic plan for Iraq is but one element of a broader strategy to expand the power and wealth of U.S.-based multinational corporations across the globe.
I think what's clear is that by the time Iraqis have some semblance of a democratic process, and who knows when that's going to be. Maybe it'll be a year from now, maybe it'll be 2 years from now. Whenever it is, it's clear that all of the key economic decisions that are going to affect the ability of that new government to act in meaningful ways, those decisions will all have already have been made, and contracts will be locked in, multi-year contracts. So this is essentially, this is about democracy. I mean, Bush has said that the war wasn't really about weapons of mass destruction. It's actually about freedom and democracy. Well, this whole issue of privatizations taking place before there's a democracy is an incredibly flagrant assault on the basic principles of self-determination. And I think we have to be really careful when we say, oh, the Reconstruction has been a crisis or it's been a disaster. Well, it's been a disaster for the Iraqi people, but it hasn't been a disaster for Bechtel. And in fact, what's happened is they have kind of bombed the country into a blank slate where they are rebuilding it in the image that is exactly prescribed by the so-called Washington Consensus of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, where all of the state industries, including oil, are going to be privatized. And at the same time, Paul Bremer, before he even had the lights back on in Baghdad, declared that Iraq was, quote-unquote, open for business, which meant that all of the foreign exports were pouring across the border. And Iraqi companies that had been suffering under 13 years of sanctions and months of lootings and then blackouts because of a lack of electricity were told that they should, you know, welcome to the free market. Now you can compete with these multinationals. And, of course, they're all closing down. So that's what I mean by a process that, say, in the Soviet Union or Argentina took 5 years is happening in Iraq, you know, in 2 months. But I think it's important, I guess, to look at such a naked exercise of so-called free market economics to see that they were never supposed to compete in the first place. I mean, the idea that they could have competed under these conditions is absolutely absurd. And I think that it really does put the lie to the idea that there is a free market on the global scale.
You have followed quite closely, and in your most recent book, wrote dispatches about the various forms that the movement that opposes corporate-led globalization has taken around the world. What can you tell us about the intersection between those groups opposing corporate-led globalization and the recent, quite astonishing peace movement that took root on almost every continent of the world?
Well, I think that there are lots of connections. I think that they aren't the same movement, but they're inseparable in so many ways. For instance, the coordinated peace demonstrations on February 15th could never have happened without the networks that were created by the globalization movements, from the World Social Forums to indie media, which was really the voice of those demonstrations and allowed people to feel that they were part of something truly global, I think in a really unique and unprecedented way. But I think that the question is, how do we deepen those connections through this period of ongoing wars and also occupation? And that's why I think it really is important to focus on what is actually happening with this so-called reconstruction or privatization disguised as reconstruction in Iraq. Because I think that Iraq is not a distraction or a sideline from the debate about the global economy and how it's progressing. I think it's the cutting edge of that debate in the sense that there is a global economic crisis. There is a recession, and there is a growing skepticism and rejection of many of the policies that we've been talking about. In Latin America, for instance, there is huge opposition to the idea of a free trade agreement of the Americas. But there's also been a steady stream of opposition to new privatizations. And what this means is that there's growing desperation from the companies that need growth to survive, which is every company, which is how capitalism works. And because of that, we are seeing this phenomenon that I called, you know, bomb before you buy, which is a flip way of describing what happened in Iraq. But I think we are, frankly and sadly, going to see more of it. So I can't, in my mind, separate the debate about globalization or free trade from an analysis of war, because to me, what we're actually seeing are wars being waged to pave the way for precisely the policies that we in the globalization movement have been opposing steadily for the past 5 years.
Do you see the anti-globalization organizations and the peace groups focusing their attention now on the post-war situation in Iraq and the privatizations and the threat, as you say, that this could be the template, the model for future engagements by the United States and their corporate sponsors?
I think it is starting to happen. But frankly, if we're to be honest, I think we have to admit that we on the left are destabilized. And I personally think more than anything else, this is the Bush strategy, which is to behave so quixotically, so unpredictably, basically to act like a crazy person, that basically all of your potential opposition is in a permanent state of destabilization, trying to figure out what the next move is going to be. You know, it's been really difficult to think strategically over the past year and a half, but I think that there's certainly consensus that we need to somehow find our bearings and understand that the fact that we're confused is not a coincidence, that it's a strategy.
That was Naomi Klein, author of Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Globalization Debate, published by Flamingo. Visit her website at www.nologo.org. In early 2000, President Clinton proposed the inclusion of prescription drug benefits in the nation's Medicare health program, but with disagreements on how the program should be organized, Congress failed to act. Now, more than 2 years later, legislation which will provide drug subsidies to senior citizens has been passed by both the House and Senate. Although differences in the two chambers' bills still need to be reconciled, the total package of benefits is estimated to cost $400 billion over the next decade. The legislation will offer beneficiaries the option of choosing either private providers or traditional fee-for-service plans. The Bush administration maintains that shifting Medicare toward private plans will reduce costs through competition. But opponents of the measure say the legislation will impose additional costs on Medicare beneficiaries, leave large gaps in coverage, and increase the program's reliance on private insurance to provide medical services. According to a recent study from the Urban Institute, Medicare's government-run program has more effectively controlled health care costs than private insurers. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Quentin Young, national coordinator with Physicians for a National Health Program and a practicing physician for 5 decades. Dr. Young assesses the Medicare prescription drug plan and explains why he advocates the adoption of a single-payer, universal health care system.
The projection for medical bill costs for the next 10 years is $1.8 trillion. That's $1,800 billion is the cost of patented drugs in the next 10 years. And the proposals that pass just bite around the edges and don't even bite in an effective way. The most generous estimate of the monies that will be spent toward these $1,800 billion is $400 billion. Less than 25% of the bill will be addressed. Now, let me show you how evil and how wrong-headed and how captive of the corporate drug companies our Congress is. You could cut that problem in half by one simple act, namely use the purchase power of bulk purchase by the federal government. It would become overwhelmingly the largest purchaser of drugs if it proceeded to buy drugs for the Medicare population. You could cut in half that $1,800 billion. Why do I say that? Because we do it already in the VA system. Our VA system, Veteran Administration system, which serves many people, although a fraction of the numbers covered by Medicare, does indeed bulk purchase in an effort to control costs. And their drugs cost between 40 and 60%, round off at 50% what they cost if you went on individual prescriptions. Who else pays that discount? Well, guess what Canada does? We go, many of us, to Canada directly or through mail order to get that 50% discount. And it isn't just Canada. It's Canada and Mexico and Europe. Everybody could get it if our Congress wasn't in the hip pocket of the corporations. And these companies would never say no. They love mass purchase. And they do understand that when you sell huge amounts of a product, you have to give discounts.
Dr. Young, the legislation that both the House and Senate offered on drug prescription benefits offers patients the option of staying with the standard government program or opting into a private health care plan. And there are some critics of this who suspect that this is a foot in the door in order to eventually wholly privatize Medicare. You want to address that for us?
I want to address it emphatically. And you're looking at somebody who aspires to be the number one critic for that terrible scheme. This administration has striven, and those that went before, I'm sorry to say, to push the American health system ever more into a market-driven, investor-owned, private system. It's exactly what you say. As a bait to deal with this terrible burden of $500, $600, $1,000 a month drug benefits, they propose to have a two-tiered system where people who join the private HMO, with government subsidy, mind you, get access to either low-cost or no-cost drugs. That's a terrible incentive. And, you know, it isn't brand new. Congress did that before by offering people who joined HMOs a drug benefit. 5 million people signed up. And the HMOs quickly, or relatively quickly, concluded that wasn't enough, this extra money they got, which is beyond what the average payment was for Medicare patients. And they proceeded to offload, and I mean offload, like you open the door and kick people out. Of the 5 million, the majority have already been dropped. Now, these patients can indeed go back to the old Medicare system, but think what that means. These people gave up their traditional source of care, a doctor they might have been with for 10, 20, 30 years, to get into the system where they got their drugs. Then in midstream, in 6, 12, 24 months in the ensuing two-year period, these for-profit HMOs said, this isn't enough money for us, goodbye. And they unceremoniously dropped them. They gave them notice, and 30 days later, as I recall, they're outside trying to reestablish connections with doctors that had been broken. There's a certain ruthlessness, a certain inhumane quality that's incompatible with decency and medical ethics.
Do you think that we're going to see any meaningful and serious debate on national health care as we approach this presidential election season?
I believe, for the negative reason, that the health system is so oppressive to our economy and does challenge our national economic health, not to mention our national health, that it will get attention. But I think we're seeing some fresh winds growing. We have to beware in the presidential group, including Dean Gephardt, that those who say we're for universal health care without saying they're for single-payer, not-for-profit systems. The reason I say that is everybody's for universal health care, no one more than the offenders. The Health Insurance Association of America, HIAA, wants universal health care. They love what's going on, and they'd like to capture with government money those last 44 million. And the Group Health Association of America, which is the HMO club, they too would like universal health care. You have to be very clear-eyed and say, we want a government single-payer system which excludes the advent of investor-driven systems if we're going to rescue this system. If we'll solve the problem of pharmaceuticals, solve the problem of having your own doctor, your own choice, and then solve the problem of fear of going broke because you got sick. And that's my farewell message to your listeners.
That was Dr. Quentin Young, National Coordinator of Physicians for a National Health Program. Contact the group by calling area code 312-782-6006 or visit their website at www.pnhp.org. While almost every state in the U.S. is suffering from a major budget crisis, California's budget meltdown dwarfs other states' problems. California is facing a shortfall of up to $35 billion, more than most states' entire budgets. This crisis has prompted a move to recall Governor Gray Davis, and his opponents are close to having enough signatures verified to accomplish this goal. If Davis is recalled, a special election for governor will be held in which Davis will run again and potentially face Republican Congressman Daryl Issa, who has declared his intention to run. The election itself will cost $30 million, money which is not in the state budget. One of the main reasons Davis opponents give for the recall move is his handling of the state's 2000-2001 energy crisis. Lost in the politicking over the recall is the role of Enron and other energy companies in manipulating the energy market to their advantage, leading to great financial hardship for consumers in the state. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Tyson Slocum, Research Director for Public Citizens' Critical Mass Energy Program. He talks about Governor Davis's role in the energy crisis, the role of his predecessor Pete Wilson in pushing through electricity deregulation, and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's lack of oversight of the energy supply during the crisis.
There's no question that a bulk of California's current fiscal and economic problems are directly attributable to the energy crisis that plagued the state from 2000 to 2001. It is true that Governor Gray Davis is guilty of poor leadership and management during that crisis, but we all have to remember that he inherited it from his predecessor, the Republican governor, Pete Wilson, who had rammed a very flawed deregulation plan which passed the legislature in California unanimously back in 1996. And we also have to point a lot of the blame to the Bush administration, and most importantly to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is the federal agency that is in charge of wholesale electricity markets. We have to remember that it was these federal officials that approved of California's deregulation plan. They were ultimately responsible watching over companies like Enron and Dynegy and Reliant and all these other companies that stole $70 billion from California consumers. And so it is not fair to totally put all the blame on Gray Davis's feet. Sure, he could have done a heck of a better job dealing with the crisis and aggressively going after these companies. But let us not forget that it was a Republican administration in Washington, D.C., and a Republican-dominated Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and a Republican governor who preceded Gray Davis that really helped usher in and cause this California energy crisis.
Bob Scheer had a column, actually, that related to this exact issue, and he said, just last week, the Republican-dominated FERC banned Enron from selling electricity as punishment for having severely distorted Western energy markets. Enron and 60 other companies were ordered to show why they should not be forced to return their illegally gained profits. Are they likely to have to actually return profits? That sounds so shocking.
If they're going to return profits, it is going to be a minuscule portion of what they actually stole from California. Reliable estimates put the theft at over $70 billion, and right now the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is looking at disgorgement of profits of about $1.8 billion. So clearly, that is woefully inadequate to the amount of money that was literally sucked out of the California economy into the pockets of wealthy executives in Houston, Texas. Clearly, the problem is that we have a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that has ultimate jurisdiction over energy markets that has taken a very lenient approach when it comes to reprimanding and punishing bad corporate actors. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission continues to be dominated by radical pro-business free market ideologues at the expense of consumers and the non-energy sector of the economy. And until we get a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that actually represents the needs of the consumers and of the overall economy, we are going to continue to have a poorly regulated or just totally unregulated energy markets. So right now, there is nothing that the Bush administration has done to demonstrate that they are committed to righting the wrongs committed by Enron and these other companies. There is nothing that Representative Issa, who I believe is leading this recall effort, is doing in Congress today to make sure that these companies that ripped off his own constituents.
This is Republican Representative Darrell Issa from California you're referring to.
Who is, I believe, leading the recall effort against
right,
Gray Davis.
Is.
Well, during the height of the California energy crisis, Issa was not out there leading the fight for enactment of price controls, which is what eventually reined in this out-of-control California energy market. The Republicans' solution, actually, at the height of the California energy crisis, was to increase deregulation, not re-regulation. There is no question that re-regulation is what ended the California energy crisis. When the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission finally enacted price controls in June of 2001, that effectively ended the price gouging and the market manipulation. Yeah. But it was Republicans, led by the Bush administration, that fought that decision tooth and nail. And it is distressing to see very little accountability on the part of these Republicans that allowed these mostly Texas-based energy companies to plunder California's consumers.
That was Tyson Slocum, Research Director of Public Citizen's Critical Mass Energy Program. Contact Public Citizen by calling area code 202-588-1000 or visit their website at www.citizen.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.